offering a most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, joining you from our studios at Prashanti Nilam, this is Prem, and with me is Arvind. And we are here to continue our discussion on the book Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba, the conversations between Dr. Hislop Swami and a few other visitors who had the opportunity to be present when these conversations were happening. And Dr. Hislop has dutifully recorded these conversations and he's presented it to us in the form of these books. And that's the base literature for our discussions in the past couple of months. We were going through a particular discussion where Swami's childhood was discussed in the concept, in the pretext of Swami's health. I think there was a discussion on Swami's, when Swami was down with appendicitis in Goa and how Swami overcame that. And in the context of that discussion, Dr. Hislop asks about Swami being badly treated by occult practitioners and medical practitioners in the early years of Swami's life. I think the reference is to the incident at Kadri, which we have spoken about. So in the course of that discussion, there was a change in topic, and I think that's the point where we had stopped. But before we refresh your memory about the question that we read and before we go into the answer that we're going to read out that Swami has given and discuss more about that, let's invite Arvind to join all of us. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem. And Sairam to all our listeners, for the nth time maybe I'm repeating that it's such a wonderful thing to go through this book, Conversations with Sathya Sai Baba, because of the wide range of questions and the depth of the answers that Swami gives. Excuse me. So it is so exciting when we anticipate, because we don't know what's coming next. In our worldly terms, the question could be deep and philosophical, or it could be pretty mundane and straightforward and simple ones. However the question is, I mean, whether deep or mundane, the answer is always beautiful and profound and always leaves something for us to think about. That is the amazing thing about having conversation with Sai, and it continues in today's episode as well. Because at this point in time, we have a visitor who is asking a question, and every time we have a visitor asking a question, it's like a complete change of topics. Most of the times, because it appears as if the visitor is seated in the interview room with Bhagwan, and like all of us, when we get an interview with Swami, we have a few burning questions, a few doubts that we wish to get clarity about. And as we are waiting there and listening to the conversation going on between Swami and whichever devotee, our mind is constantly ruminating on the question. In fact, sometimes that question becomes like a distraction. I'm not able to focus and listen to what Swami is saying because of the question that is running in my mind. And on a few occasions when I have got the opportunity to be present when Swami is talking to a few members in a group, I have noticed that Swami answers my question not possibly because the question is very, very important, but possibly because once that is answered, I'm able to sit back and focus on the actual conversation that is happening. So
very true. In fact, you know, one of my classmates was once narrating. Swami had called him for an interview.
Mm-hmm.
And along with him, Swami had also called an elder. And I mean, from the conversation that happened inside the interview room, he gathered that he must be a very long-time devotee. But Swami had not spoken to him for quite some time, and he was getting this interview after a long while. So he could find that, you know, the what you would call quote-unquote chemistry between Swami and this person was a little awkward. And Swami was every now and then looking at this boy to, you know, and exchanging glances to say that, you know, this is so awkward, and this person seems to be asking all kinds of, you know, the timing of the questions still don't seem to be right. For instance, he was saying that Swami was talking to him, and he was asking some spiritual questions, and Swami was replying to that. And he was asking also a few personal questions about his career and all that. And all of a sudden, this person will say, "Swami, I have a question." And Swami look at him and say, "Okay, what is it?" So he says, "Swami, this ring you gave me in the year 1986, it has a Shirdi Baba's image. What is the significance of that?" And it was so out of place. And
not in the flow.
Right. And Swami will look at this student and Swami will say, "What am I supposed to do?" Right. And he did this over and over again, 3 or 4 times in the middle of a conversation. So Mucha Swami had to say that, you know, nothing. It just means the Chirdi Baba, Parthi Baba and all divinity, all forms are one and the same.
Mm.
So he said, okay. And then after a few minutes, again another question like this. You know, Swami, why did you say this in some discourses, something like that. And typically, you know, as you're rightly saying, maybe these are visitors who are sitting there. I mean, in their own right, they have their own relationship with Swami, but they might have come with their streams of thoughts and they are trying to put it in front of Swami. But most lovingly, Swami is answering that also with the same, you know, respect that that sincerity deserves.
That's why, you know, I was saying that we don't know the profundity or the mundane nature or the intentions of the questioner because no details are given about it. And there's no way you can judge that. But one thing we can definitely be sure is that the answers are coming from a very pure place. In fact, from the purest place possible because it's coming from God. So that is what makes this whole exercise of going through this book very, very interesting and energizing. And speaking of the exercise of going through the book, the next question that the visitor asks is about exercise. He says, he asks Swami, is an exercise program important? In the West, exercise is considered to be of great value. And Swami replies, exercise is extolled in the West as a way to digest excess food and sublimate the sex drive. Swami, who is completely removed from the area of sensory thoughts, takes a very small quantity of food and needs no exercise. Yet, this body is very strong. For those engaged in work, there is exercise. The idea of exercise comes to those who are idle and who do not have the full responsibility of work. Moderation in life is necessary, otherwise there is no reserve of energy. Food must be in the body for some time for the benefit of the energy reserve. Too much exercise uses up the food energy before it can be added to the reserve. So there is no gain. Likewise, the human system cannot withstand too much talking. One MP talked for 2 hours and felt dizzy. Nobody can continue talking. That is, nobody except Swami, who has been doing it for years and years. There are multiple points that we need to, you know, cover and discuss possibly in this answer. And I'll just begin off with one point where Swami is saying that for those who are engaged in work continuously, there is automatically exercise. But then, for those who are idle, who do not have the responsibility of full work, they need this concept of exercise. I think we can extend this, we can understand where Swami is coming from when we look at how the history of work has evolved. You know, most about 50, 60 years ago, I think that's when this conversation is taking place. From a point in time, which is 50 years ago, if we look back another 10, 20 years, almost all professions and occupations concerned some amount of physical work, be it carpentry, be it farming, be it pottery, everything involved a lot of physical work, because of which Swami says that when you are engaged in work, there is exercise automatically. And for only those who are not engaged in work, they need to do that specific exercise. Now, in the modern context, it has changed in such a manner that even though we are engaged in work, we need exercise, because definitely today, most of the work is predominantly mental or emotional also, if I can say so. I really feel, for example, Prem, the kind of work that we are doing is majorly into the mental and emotional sphere. We hardly have any physical component. I mean, if you consider walking to a studio, getting up and asking a doubt from a colleague or checking on the status of work with somebody else, that is possibly the only compulsory physical activity that is involved in our work. Otherwise, most of it is mental, and a large part of it is also emotional because it's psychological understanding, and you know, that is what comes in. There is an emotional quotient and intelligent quotient that is required. And this is the case of work across the globe. And that's why I think Swami is saying that when you are idle, I don't think when Swami says you're idle, he means we're sitting joblessly. But physically we are idle. That's why we also, you know, keep getting these forwards via emails or social media apps which say that even as you're sitting at your work, get up, turn your head to the left and right, take 10 steps, drink a glass of water. The idea is to forcibly make you do some amount of physical work, because physically we are idle despite doing a lot of work on a day-to-day basis.
And absolutely. I think Swami's thoughts on exercises, there was also a question based on what we mentioned in the end of last week that we're going to answer. I mean, we're going to read about this particular topic that Swami's been posed. The thing with Swami's, and Swami's always spoken about exercise, Swami would give himself as an example. Even as we were students, Swami would often, you know, say that I'm always that same size, 108 pounds.
Weight,
say,
yes.
Right? And my weight has never changed. Though Swami is saying here that, you know, he doesn't do exercise in that sense, Swami was never lived a, you know, sedentary life in that sense. The amount of walking that Swami used to do, in the name of darshan, Swami used to walk, take so many rounds even as we would sit. But apart from that, Swami would walk so much after his dinner and
around his cot in the room.
Right. In fact, you know, the Vrindavan hostel, one of the you know, USPs of the Vrindavan hostel is if you had any of the rooms in the sea floor in the east wing of the hostel, which is facing the Trai Vrindavan, now you have the Kalyan Mandapam there. But before the Kalyan Mandapam actually came, from one of the seafloor rooms, that entire wing, you could directly see Swami's dining room. And many, many of them have seen, and you know, it used to be, there's a lookout for that. After Swami's dinner, they would see Swami taking rounds around the dining table. Because that, you know, it used to be a circular hall, Trai Vrindavan on top, I think. So Swami was, you know, Swami took very good care of his body in that sense. And we know, you know, the personal care that Swami took about how his feet were always clean, how his hands were always clean, his robe was always very well pressed and neat, and all of that Swami used to take care. But I think the most important thing which Swami used to say is putting into perspective why you are doing all of that. Right? As Swami would say, the body is given as an instrument for achieving higher goals of life, and for that it has to be maintained in good balance and good health.
Sharira madhyam kalu dharma sadhanam,
Swami would say. And I think that is the most important outlook that one must have. A few years back, I think I had a question on the Answering Booth program where a devotee had asked about the difference between yoga and physical exercise. And when I had actually gone and researched where physical exercise as a, you know, daily activity came to existence, exactly what you were saying. It started post-industrial revolution. When everything, you know, slowly, the
machines took over.
Right, the machines took over, the manual labor was reducing. And, you know, just like as you said about us, most of the people who are working in the corporate world today do not have any physical activity as part of their profession. Right? So it became necessary to introduce a component where what physical activity you would have done, sweeping and mopping your house or cutting wood in the forest or doing agriculture in the land, all of that had to be replaced in some form of physical activity, and that's how exercise came. And even before that, the whole origin of exercise was battle readiness, right? Because most of the men in a country would be called to be part of the army. So they had to be kept ready for battle, and those were times when, you know, you never know when a battle would break out, and battles would go on for years together. So if you see from the from that outlook, the purpose of exercise was, as you said, to make a place for some kind of physical activity in a otherwise very sedate lifestyle, and for this kind of battle readiness. And that's why if you see even all sports, it would be wrestling, it would be throwing something, it would be throwing a javelin, throwing a weight, everything which was related somewhat in some means to a warfare, right? And thereafter, if you see the whole idea of gymnasiums and all that, it started off in the Greek Roman cultures, you know, where they started celebrating physical beauty and all of that. But then again, with the rise of the Christian era, that was again falling because the body was seen to be as an you know, carrier of sin. You should not celebrate it too much. So up and on. And finally, when you come to the 20th century with all the industrial revolution and everything, and then, you know, this happens with everything in our lifestyle. Once marketing steps in, it becomes an industry. And fitness became an industry. Fitness became so intertwined with the fashion industry, and that's what we are in today. But the most important thing which Swami says here, as I mentioned, is to have that right outlook. What is physical exercise for? You might choose any form of exercise. In fact, we all did jogging. That person who had written to us had asked, is it wrong to do physical exercise, like taking part in athletics or physical activity involved in some sports and all of that? Not at all. Because Swami made us go for jogging. Swami built a basketball court for us, a tennis court for us. Swami encouraged...
Indoor stadium.
Right, and the initial year, Swami used to come and sit through all the matches. Swami would sit through the volleyball matches and cricket matches and all of that. So Swami was never against it, but the perspective was very, very important. What are you doing that for? And that is why Swami would give a lot of emphasis to yoga, because compared to physical exercise and physical activity, the very purpose of yoga itself was to maintain body balance for a person on the spiritual path. So that when something is created with that pure purpose, it will to a certain extent have that pure purpose, you know, embedded in its practices. So today, though people take up yoga just as any other form of beautification of the body, in some way, I think it would probably turn your mind inward towards that goal.
See, when you say the marketing of health and fitness has happened, in a way, even the marketing of yoga has happened.
Right, so exactly.
It has also lost its purity in that sense. I think when we discuss on whether exercise is good or not, that's where the next key word that Swami brings in is important, which is about moderation. You know, I have noticed that when I got a fever and I fell sick, I felt too tired to walk or do anything. I didn't feel like doing anything. I just felt like lying in the bed, covered up, wrapped up and cocooned. It felt very good. And it was a viral fever, so I was down for about 3-4 days. But after 2 days of continuously sleeping, somehow lying down cocooned did not help. Though I had a fever and it was a viral fever, so it was still there, what gave me a good relief was actually getting up from bed, walking out of the house and taking a walk for 20 minutes. And you know, interestingly what happened was, I felt so good that I completed my dinner and I said, I'm going to go for another walk. But you know, again after the walk, I was down and exhausted. Though it's looking like a very trivial narration, what I noticed is, the minute we go into the excesses, the same thing that makes you feel good starts making you feel bad, feel miserable in fact. You eat one ice cream, you feel good, eat three of them, you feel horrible. So the same thing holds good with exercise as well. Swami says that you do exercise but in moderation. And we have seen fatigue set in. You know, from the past 1 or 2 years, I have been trying to see what I can do to keep my weight under check. Now for that I found a very good thing is to play sports. I'll play badminton. I would like to do some jogging or some brisk walking. We all have those devices that count the number of steps we have taken. So do all these things, Fitbit or pedometer and all that. But if we do only this without focusing on the diet part of it, you know, it also involves dietary control. If we do that without focusing on the diet part of it, we are not going to see the benefits. In fact, even as recently as a week ago, I came across a very scholarly and academic article which brings out some very, very interesting facts. It says that, again, as always, because there's a lot of research happening there, it's all based on studies in America, in the United States of America. It says that historically, since the beginning of time, this is the period where the maximum number of Americans are exercising. Mm-hmm. And yet, this is the time when the maximum number of Americans are obese. So they were doing a research in that, and complementary to this finding, they also have another study which says that this is the time when the Americans are earning their highest per capita income. And yet, this is the time when the most number of Americans are not satisfied and they're not having sufficient savings. Savings are at the lowest, though the per capita income is at the highest. Exercising at the highest, yet obesity is at also the highest. So what they brought out through that article was the fact that being fit doesn't depend just on exercising. They said instead what exercise is doing is, those who are prone to eating now feel justified in eating some fries or burgers because they feel they have exercised. So the calories consumed because of your indulgence or what you call as cheating, no problem, because I have done exercise, is adding up more calories than what you actually burned down by exercise. Without exercising, if you try to eat, you feel a guilt that, hey, I have not done exercise, so I should not eat. So that prevents you. But now without that, now you have done exercise, you feel that I deserve to eat this. The same thing they say is happening with investments as well. Because you're earning more, you feel that I'm justified in spending more. So though you're earning more, you're spending more, you're not saving enough. So earnings are at the highest, savings are at the lowest. I think that is what it is when it comes to exercise as well. We have to do it in moderation. Because I want to lose weight, I just cannot go all out and keep exercising without focusing on what I'm eating. In fact, if my exercising is adding to my, if I can say, arrogance or overconfidence that no matter anyway, I'm burning it so I can eat more, it will be damaging. Because though Swami says that he never exercised, we also know physically how much Swami ate. What extreme control he exercised. You know, the amount of food Swami ate was the same whether he was eating a ragi ball or whether he was eating a 9-course meal at a devotee's home when Swami would go as a guest. On a few occasions when we have been present, we have seen they make 35 items. Whether there is only 2 items in his traditional meal in his room or 35 items, the quantity Swami eats would be the same. What amazing self-control that is. Because I don't think you and me do that. I mean, you know, if we have 35 items, we tuck in and think that let me control some other time. The quantity and quality of food that we eat varies so extremely depending on our taste bud. And I think that shows, you know, a greater exercise would be exercising sense control. Now that is the reason why Swami physically also was so fit, though he exercised very little and though he ate very little.
Very true. In fact, I think that's what Swami is mentioning here about his eating habits also. And the one problem with, you know, observing Swami eat, and a few people have asked this, does it mean that even we should eat that much quantities? Is that what Swami is suggesting? I don't know if I can answer that straight. The thing is, you know, Swami ate so little, but how much did Swami feed us, right? Whenever there was a treat, whenever there was Swami visiting the hostel, or when Swami was, coming, taking students to Kodaikanal and all of that, Swami would insist that the students eat well. The boys should eat well, and Swami would say, eat their fill. I think one part of Swami's extreme control over his eating habits is that there is no better way Swami could have set an example for us. Right? That's probably the standard, that's probably the highest we should achieve, hope to reach. As you are saying, it is not about the quantity, it is about completely detaching the food that you eat from your tastes and from your likes and dislikes. You're not bound by what you like and what you don't like. You know, the quantity is the same. I think that's probably the most important takeaway from there. But Swami would say that you have to eat well. Swami would also say that you should, you know, 1/3 of the stomach should be filled. But the point that Swami is making here about, as you rightly said, moderation. In fact, Swami's Jnanavahini, there's one point which when I read, see, whenever we speak about yogis or people in the Himalayas, we always think of only the extremes. Somebody who's not eaten for so many days.
Austerities,
right? You talk about putting your body through the grind. But in Swami's Jnanavahini, Swami mentions, I think, 3 or 4 points that any person who's on the path of jnana, who's on the path of spirituality, should overcome. In that one, of course, Swami says is sleep. You should not... And when Swami says you should overcome sleep, it's not that you should not sleep. Swami is saying that you should not sit for meditation or sadhana feeling sleepy. That's what Swami says. So give your body adequate sleep so that sleep does not become an obstacle, Swami says. I think that's a very subtle point that Swami makes. And in that context, Swami is saying that there is always a danger of doing something in excess. And that should be avoided in the spiritual path. And in that, Swami says, you could end up over-exercising. You could end up over-walking. You could end up doing more of what one thing is required. So that is why the idea that this is all meant for balance, you know, even when we speak about yoga, Swami would say that what you are referring to as yoga in the modern day, what is being marketed as yoga in the modern day, is 1/8 of yoga. You know, Ashtanga, Patanjali's Ashtanga Yoga, one is yogasana in that.
Asana.
That you're taking one and you're marketing that. It's only one eighth. That's why Swami, whenever he speaks about yoga, he would say yama, niyama, pratyahara.
Right? Pranayama, pratyahara.
Swami would say that you should have discipline, you should have, eating should be moderated, and then you should have, you know, dhyana should be there, dharana should be there. Only then it is complete yoga. Only then it will reach to samadhi. You can't do one eighth of it and expect that you will become a yogi and you will reach samadhi. So you say it's not like that. And that is why the whole idea that this is a spiritual journey. The way you approach everything changes if that way you look at it. That, you know, we are not here to enjoy this body, this life. But this body, this life is a boat which is given to reach a state which you will enjoy eventually.
Like they say, I do not live to eat, but right. I eat to live.
Exactly.
I might be reading a bit too much into this, but another thought that struck me is when Swami says that food must be in the body for some time for the benefit of energy reserve. See, combining this statement with Swami's statement on moderation, while Swami always said that Swami is always 108 pounds, it definitely means that his weight never went above it, so he's not overeating. At the same time, it also means that his weight never went below 108 pounds, which shows that moderation, balance and maintaining. So, therefore, when we think of these, it doesn't mean that Swami is starving. It doesn't mean that Swami is overeating as well. That's why Swami would be against overeating. At the same time, Swami would also not encourage fasting, you know, for any reason. In fact, when sometimes students would feel that Swami is upset with them, in order to please him, they would try to do fasting and Swami would be very strongly against it. I don't remember the details of the incident, but Jain sir had once narrated how when in the hostel, some of the students took over a mass kind of fasting to please Swami. They got to know that for 2 days, Swami himself had not had food. And you know, it made them feel so horrible. It also made them realize what Swami must be feeling when we do this. When we punish the body for crimes committed by the mind or something else like that. So, when Swami says there has to be some food in the body for the benefit of the energy reserve, when we see scientifically, the first thing to be broken down by the body is glucose, sugar. A little tougher than that, something that consumes little more time is fats. And the thing that takes the longest time to be digested is proteins. And also Swami says 1/3 of your stomach should always have food. I just felt that this is also an indication on the kind of food that we should eat. You know, there should be some reserve in the stomach always, meaning our diet must consist of proteins and it should not just be sugary and starch based. Because sugary and starch based are the ones that lead to putting on of weight. Right. They also are the ones that get broken down and assimilated so fast that you start feeling hungry, though your body has sufficient reserves, because glucose is immediately broken down. That is the reason why if somebody is feeling faint or tired, they immediately give them glucose, because it gives instant energy. The flip side of that instant energy is that it's broken down immediately, and so you start feeling hungry again. And that is why, you know, when you look at ragi that Swami used to eat, ragi was his favorite, and ragi is largely constituted by proteins. Among all the grains that we produce in India, millets, the finger millet especially, ragi, which is high in the protein component. So I also feel, this is my own understanding, that when Swami says that there should be some energy reserve always in the stomach, meaning there should be a good component of protein in the diet that we take in, and it should not just be starch and carbohydrate, because that is what most of our junk foods are made of. Most of our fast foods and junk foods are all starchy and sugary. And therefore, when we talk of exercising and eating and dieting, all this matter and they count.
True. And for people who might ask, you know, did Swami ever tell boys to do exercise and all that? I think one of the most common sites we would see, in fact, even in some of the Kodai videos, you would see this. If at all Swami comes across a little plump boy, you know, one thing is Swami would call them pakoda. And invariably, so many times it has happened, Swami will tell, you know, go for jogging. You know, so it's not like Swami was against the idea of these kind of exercises, of, you know, modern day exercises of jogging and sprinting and push-ups and all that. Swami would say that, you know, you're putting on weight. I think in a way, these modern exercises are pretty much like your allopathy medication. Sometimes it is required in a certain extent to quickly arrest the symptoms quickly pull back a little bit. But if you look at some of these practices like yoga and, you know, food, looking at what you eat and all that, these are meant for long-term purposes. As, you know, Swami was saying, the whole idea is to ensure that there are no obstacles in the path to spirituality, and you're just ensuring that your body, your health, and the requirements of this body do not become an obstacle on this path.
I think that's the perfect and beautiful summary. To ensure that the body is fit to carry us on the spiritual path. And how do we know that the body is fit to carry us on the spiritual path? We are no longer obsessed with thoughts of the body. The body doesn't become a distraction.
Exactly. In fact, even when you're talking about fasting and all of that, Swami's only point against fasting, if you really look at it, Swami would say, when you're fasting, are you thinking of God?
You're thinking of the dosa being...
If you're able to think of God, that much fasting is fine. In fact, first time when they wanted to do the Akhanda Bhajan, you know, that's what Mrs. Geeta Mohan Ram says, that when they went and told Swami that, Swami, we want to do 24 hours bhajans and we don't want to eat in that period. We'll eat prasadam only at the end of it. The first thing which Swami said was, it's a good thing. A little bit of disciplining of the body is always good. So in that sense, it is good that, you know, you are detaching yourself from the needs of the body for that, you know, if intermittent fasting, that's another thing which is being, which is catching up now, you know, as a fitness fad, right? If intermittent fasting is meant for that, are you getting better self-control? I mean, everything from Swami's point of view, everything is that. Mm. Is it leading to self-control? Is it leading to you thinking less of the body? Are you less obsessed with the needs of the body? It's all only in that point of view.
And so therefore, if you are thinking too much of the body because it is unfit and exercise is making you fit, do exercise because it reduces you thinking about the body.
But so much in thinking about the body.
Because you get injuries, sports injuries, you get dislocations and you're stressed.
Or you
stressed.
Get too obsessed with the looks. I think
with
both
the looks,
ways.
Yes.
Right.
So if the exercise is itself making you think about the body too much, then I think...
Right.
So the key term over here is moderation. And after this, again, Hislop asks a question. It's again a topic that is totally different from exercise. So before going to that topic, we'll take a quick little break and continue with this conversation after the break.
Darshan do Bhagwan, darshan do Bhagwan, darshan do Bhagwan, darshan do चरण कमल पर अर्पण करो मन चरण कमल पर अर्पण करो मन करुणामृत भगवान करुणा करो भगवान करु करो भगवान हर पल हर क्षण गाते रहो मना दिन सखा भगवान शिरडी के प्रभु परतेश्वर साई प्राण दिखाओ सायरा
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were going to begin another question, which is also a different topic compared to what we were speaking about. And Hislop asked this question. The previous one was by one of the visitors who asked about exercises. Hislop asks, Swami, hippies are seen wherever one goes. It is difficult for an older person to relate to that subculture. It does not seem to express values that can be taken seriously. And Swami responds to that by saying, the hippies' ideas are based on no work, drugs, begging, and free relationship between the sexes. Baba gave some of them work to do in the print shop. They did not do it. Baba offered funds to go home. They did not want to go. They do not understand karma, that work produces results, as it is understood in India. Dharma does not have an equivalent word in English. Righteousness is work. Truth is truth in words, and truth and love in the heart is dharma. So that was Swami's answer to this interesting question. I think those times, 1960s, 1970s, this hippies culture was in its peak. For those younger generation listeners who probably don't know what this hippies culture is, I think a lot of youngsters, especially in their early 20s and even late teens, they would come away to India, they would roam around in ashrams in Rishikesh, in the in the foothills of Himalayas. You know, they would renounce, they would quote unquote renounce their own family, their citizenship, and they would think that they are like yogis. And not only in these places, but even in the cities, you would find a lot of them, you know, practicing their misunderstood ideas of spirituality. A lot of people and a lot of ashrams were filled with these kind of people, and even Swami's ashram had a lot of these hippies visiting. A few of the very senior devotees in very good positions in the organization who are guiding youngsters, who are doing a phenomenal job as office bearers in the organization. Some of them came to Swami in that period. You know, maybe we can call them hippies, I'm not too sure. But with mixed ideas of what is right, what is wrong, what is spirituality and what is realization and all of that. And some of them took Swami's advice, like as Swami is saying here, some of them took Swami's advice very seriously, took Swami seriously, and they are where they are today. But a lot of them, Swami did show a lot of love to them, Swami did give them guidance. Many of them spent a lot of time here, never to return again after that. And I think each one has their own journey. But what Swami is using this question to answer or discuss about is a very serious topic, which is more important. And whether we are hippies or not, I think it's important for us what Swami is talking about here.
Yes, actually, you know, when you are speaking about what hippies are actually, it just struck me that the hippie culture that started off at that time is possibly an expression of something much deeper. And that is existing even to this day in the world.
Right.
The expression of enjoying the pleasures without taking on their responsibilities. Now, any stage in life, anything that we do, we are responsible for the action. And we also enjoy the fruits of the action. When we try to start separating the pleasures from the responsibilities, I think it results in what we call as what was then known as the hippie culture. Even this day, for example, when we take the institution of marriage as an example. Yes, marriage has its pleasures, but marriage has its responsibilities as well. And many people would not like to bear the burden of the responsibilities of marriage, whether it is taking care of the family. You know, the moment you get married, you no longer think of yourself as a person. You have to think as a unit, at least as a family. Starting off with you and your spouse, then you, your spouse and your children. So that's why Swami would say that, you know, family is like a burden. You come as a two-legged animal. You then become four-legged, then six-legged, then eight legs. In fact, Swami would ask also like that, eight legs or six legs? Meaning whether you have now got one kid or two kids. Definitely, because every addition in the family is an additional responsibility. That is the burden part of the family. But there are joys that the family gives also. The joy of companionship, the joy of intimacy at all levels. All this comes in. So, I think society has been built in a manner that there are both pleasures and responsibilities associated with everything. But today, like in those hippie days, we see that we are always trying to separate the pleasure from the responsibility and see if we can take only the pleasure throughout the responsibility, you know. That's why we see concepts like live-in relationships, wherein you're trying to bring in the pleasures of a marriage without having the responsibilities. They say, yeah, we are just living in, we are not married, we are just living together. All these kind of modern ideas that we see, I feel, is nothing but a representation of that same concept wherein we try to take the pleasure without the responsibilities. You know, when, again, on another occasion when I was sick, the doctor told me that fruits will be good, but don't take fruit juice. So I was wondering, what is the difference between fruit and fruit juice? Then the doctor said that, no, see, fruit juice has a lot of sugar. I said, but what if I take only, you know, pulp fruit juice, like without any added fruit. He says, no, even then, he said, if you drink apple juice, the equivalent of one glass of apple juice would require you to consume 8 or 9 apples. Now what is happening in apple juice is the sugar and sweet part of 8 or 9 apples is being given to you without the fiber and other important things that the fruit contains.
Right.
In any normal day, no way would you eat 8 apples. You eat 2 apples and you're full and you're fine. But you can easily drink 2 glasses of apple juice. So it shows that, you know, even in a concept like eating, we go behind trying to see if we can separate the pleasure and, you know, without taking on the other part. Even like, I remember as a child, a cake would be given. I would like to lick off the cream from the cake and I would not eat the whole cake. We see children doing that. Eat off the cream and not eat the cake. The entire cake is like junk food, but relatively the cake part is healthier than the cream part. But that's how it is. And I think even this hippie culture is nothing but an expression of that, wherein we are trying to run away and escape the responsibility and just enjoy the pleasure. And as Swami, without explicitly stating it, makes it very clear, this might work and give us joy and pleasure for a short time, but it is not going to give us happiness. In fact, it will land us into greater trouble. That's why Swami says, I try to tell these hippies that you work here. I try to give them job. They didn't want to. I told them, I'll give you money, go back home. They didn't want to. Because Swami says that they are not able to understand this concept of karma and dharma. And then Swami is telling Hislop that because in English there is no proper word for dharma and karma. Dharma and karma are so deep concepts. As you sow, so shall you reap. If you shy away from your responsibilities towards others and towards society for the sake of your own pleasure, you will definitely have to reap the same reward, which is somebody else or the society itself will shy away from its responsibilities towards you for the sake of its own pleasure. And at that time you will feel cheated and hurt, but there's nothing you will be able to do about it because that is what you have sown. So Swami says that that is not the right thing to do. I feel this is the message there, that no enjoying anything without taking on the responsibilities associated with it. And as the famous dialogue goes, with great power comes great responsibilities. But I want to enjoy great power without the responsibility of the power. I want to enjoy great wealth without taking on the responsibility that great wealth brings. I want to command so many people without actually being a true leader and trying to find out about their concerns and their problems. This will not work. It will result in bad karma. The bad karma comes back to us. That is why Swami also, along with karma, emphasizes on dharma, because there is dharma for every level, you know. If you are the head of an organization, there's a dharma for that. If you are the head of a family, there's a dharma that you have to follow. So Swami says, doesn't matter what position you are in life, ensure that you follow the dharma, else you'll be faced with bad karma.
And the other point that Swami mentions is, you know, dharma is, Swami says, righteousness in work, or the methodology. Because if there is one way in which, you know, the hippie culture is different from a frivolous lifestyle, right? And these days you have modern, no strings attached kind of relationships, and you don't want to take on the responsibilities. If there is one way the hippies' culture, at least the base from where this whole thing comes, is different, is they had a sense of spirituality. There was a craving for a spiritual understanding. In fact, much of the hippie culture was born out of disillusionment from war. You know, it came from a period when, after the Cold War, after the two world wars, you know, they disliked authority, they disliked countries fighting over each other. So it was born out of that feeling of, you know, we are here to express love, we are here to, there's brotherhood, there are no boundaries, there are no countries. That's why many of the hippies who had come to India, I think we spoke to one devotee who had come in that period. A lot of them would go to Rishikesh or any of these, you know, Kashi or somewhere, and they would throw their passports into Ganga. Mm-hmm. They would say, we don't belong to one country, we belong to the whole world, right? So it came from a very pure thought in that sense, that there should be love between everybody and spirituality. But what mistake they were doing is very similar to a mistake which most people do, which pretty much is symbolized in the Bhagavad Gita, right? When you think I don't belong to anybody, then what do you say? That I'm not going to listen to anybody. You know, when you say that I am not somebody's daughter, I am not somebody's son, I don't belong to one country, then you not only detach yourself, not only does that spiritual detachment come, but you also detach yourself from duty towards that person. you also run away from what you're supposed to do towards your country, towards your society and all of that. And that is precisely the simplistic solution that you take to a very complex problem. Right? When you say that you're not the body, then you try to detach everything that is related to the body. So I don't belong to the family that has brought me up. I don't belong to the, Swami would say, the society is responsible for what you are today. How can you not owe a debt to the society? So even though you're spiritual beings, even though you're not the body, the way of getting to that understanding has a methodology. And Swami would say that is dharma. And that dharma involves karma. That dharma also involves you doing activity that is also referred to as dharma. And that's why dharma becomes a very complicated word. Dharma is also religion. Dharma is also the path. Dharma is also the activity that you have to do towards your family, towards your relatives and your friends and your society and your corporation, everything. So that's why dharma becomes a very complex word. And the fundamental mistake is what Arjuna was trying to do. He was saying that if I act, I might sin. So the best thing is not to act. And Krishna tells him that, boss, look at this, even by not acting, you add up to your karma. You know, if you are supposed to do a certain duty towards your parents, if you remain inactive, that way also you are adding to bad karma. So the concept of karma, when you talk of it as consequences of actions, there are consequences even for inaction. And that is why to understand this, it's more complicated, and that is why it is not a simple thing. If you go to a doctor and you say that my liver is not functioning, if the doctor says, okay, I'll remove it off, you don't want such a doctor. You want a doctor who's going to try to salvage that, and there is a methodology by which that same liver can be treated and made useful to you. And that's the whole idea of life. You know, you've been put in a certain situation, you work with the situation around, and there is a means by which you go beyond that.
Now, extending your example of the liver and the doctor, see, I think this is where the problem comes. This discussion comes up a little later in the conversations as well, where Swami says, knowing the avatar is different from having faith in the avatar.
Right.
They're very different. In the same way, knowing the concept of detachment and spirituality is different from actually living it. See, when you look at the case of Ramana or Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, though their body got afflicted with cancer and some deadly problems, they didn't bother about healing it. That is true detachment. I'm saying this because there was a case of an elderly person coming and saying, you know, at a young age, I decided to, you know, give up my energies, everything for Swami, and that's what I have done.
Mm-hmm.
All my life I have done for Swami only. Now I'm old. Nobody takes care of me. I need help, but there's nobody to help me. Why is this happening to me? So, I didn't know. I mean, I consoled that person, but I was just thinking that when you, in the prime of your youth, when you're having all your strength, you shun away all your responsibility towards your parents. You don't keep in touch with your family. You don't do anything and justify all of that by saying, I'm turning towards God. If that faith is truly firm, then you won't bother if, like Ramakrishna Paramahamsa or Ramana Maharshi, you won't bother if nobody is looking at you. I feel that now at an age when you are not having the strength, you are now seeking company, you are getting lonely, you are saying nobody comes to meet me, nobody is talking with me. You should have done, you reap what you sow. So that means that our understanding is only theoretical. I know what is detachment, but I have not experienced or practiced it because I am not detached. It is just that I am using detachment as an excuse at that point of time in life when I am having all my strength and energies and when I am supposed to contribute. When I am in my 30s and 40s, I am in my prime. I have all physical strength, mental energies. I have everything. That is the time I must contribute to society, to people, do seva, everything. And that only comes back as possibly, you know, retirement or pension later on when others take care of us when we are old. When I am having this, I waste away frivolously. Say, like as Swami says, in drugs, in pleasures, and say, no, I am seeking God, I don't care. The body is now strong, it's able to recuperate and recover. 20 years from now, it won't happen. And then I say, nobody is caring about me. The doctor says he'll pluck out my liver. Naturally, you didn't care for the doctor, you didn't care for society. So when I say I am detached and I don't need society, am I truly detached? That is the thing to ponder about. And that's why knowing spirituality is one thing, practicing and living it is a totally different thing. That's why Swami says, don't rush, no extremity. practice detachment, at the same time do your dharma, do your roles, do your responsibility, do your duties, don't shun away from duties.
And you know, when Swami is saying here that I would give them money, I would send them back, I would give them work, it's pretty much an understatement, you know, how much Swami has done to these people who would come. In fact, this is not in Swami's words, even those people, I think there are a few videos on the internet, some of these people who came in that period and who were very, very serious about what Swami was saying and how Swami guided them. One of the things that Swami would do is, Swami would write letters to their parents and say that, you know, these people are there in my ashram, don't worry about them. Because, you know, some of them were 19-year-olds, 21-year-olds who have left houses, you know, and parents were worried about them. So Swami would make devotees like Hislop find out the whereabouts of this, you know, family from where they came. And Swami would write letters to them saying that, no, they're with me, don't worry. In a few months, I'll send them back. And Swami would counsel them. And Hislop says in one of the talks that that was one of the occasions where Swami would take money from devotees. Because Swami would take money in dollars from some of the American devotees. And Swami would give it to these, you know, hippies. And Swami would buy a ticket for them, give it to them, and Swami would give them some money in dollars, and Swami would say, go back home. You know, that much care Swami would take. Many of them would work in Swami's gardens in Vrindavan. Swami would make them work in the press, as Swami is saying here. Right? And it's nothing but Swami acknowledging that, you know, somewhere there is a good motive. Right? They have got into wrong ways. You know, probably they've got into drugs, and as Swami is saying, wrong relationships and all of that. But Swami was so patiently and lovingly guiding us, you know, like each one of us. You know, we all have wrong in our ideas in some way or the other. But Swami chose to see the little good initiative and you know, intention in us and guided. And there are, I think, beautiful stories for listeners who would like to listen to that. I think they can go to YouTube and they can search. There's some one on Swami's, the Swami's hippies or something. Also, if they search in YouTube, they'll find Swami used to call some of them rowdies. So, rowdies of the 1960s or something like that. There were a couple of DVDs which were released by them. Beautiful. I mean, the time that they spent with Swami, it's precious. When Swami is saying here that I helped them, it's truly an understatement of how much Swami did for them.
Based on what Swami has replied, it is natural that Hislop gets the next question, which is, how does one determine the particular dharma appropriate to himself? So Swami is saying you should not run away from your dharma, from your karma, should not run away from your duty. So Hislop is asking, then how does one know what is the dharma appropriate? What if I want to pursue God sincerely? Like you said, even the hippies have their innermost motives true, the heart is in the right place. Just the expression and the way they're putting it into practice has gone awry. So here Hislop is asking, how does one determine that? And Swami says, one has to inquire. Ask questions such as, I am a man. What is animal work? Am I male or female? Am I young or old? And so forth. Because animal behavior is not correct for humans. And a man should not behave like a woman. If an old person plays with dolls like a child, he is ridiculous. If a youngster takes a cane and walks like an old person, he is ridiculous. The work which is righteous, true, well considered in truth, that is dharma. Thought, word and deed must coincide. The other person must be understood. Do you feel hungry if another person is hungry? You must feel his hunger as your own. So Swami gives one very easy practical tip wherein he says that ask questions of who you are. And though that is the ultimate spiritual quest as to who am I, Swami says that that quest is also helpful in your worldly duties and dharmas. Though I might not arrive at the answer that Shivoham or I am the immortal Atma in the first go, if I say I am a man, I am a father, I am an employee of Radio Sai, I am a Sai devotee. Swami says, look at all the things that you are claiming and see whether your behavior matches what you claim yourself to be. If you claim yourself to be a father, is your behavior or manners or the way you do things matching that of a father? If you call yourself as a son, if you call yourself as a human being, Swami says, if you are a human being and you behave like an animal, that is wrong then, that is not dharma. because dharma is being what you are. Swami would say that the fire burns. It is the dharma of the fire. I mean, irrespective of where it is, what it is, in the, whatever condition, it lives, it does it because it's its dharma. In the same way, Swami says, find out who you are and behave according to the answer that you derive yourself. I think that's a very, very good starting point for us to know which particular dharma is appropriate to ourselves.
Right. I think just that inquiry, as Swami was saying, that just find out who, you know, what is your role and responsibility. And I mean, that's what Swami would say is the essence of the Bhagavad Gita. So I mean, say mama dharma, find out what is my duty at this point in time and do it as perfectly as you can. But when Swami says this, that, you know, talks about feeling the other person's pain, the work which is, Swami says, do you feel...
thought, word and deed must coincide.
Right, coincide. The other person must be understood. Do you feel hunger if another person is hungry? You must feel his hunger. As Swami is saying it, it seems like something which is difficult. You know, how do you feel another person's pain? And is that the goal of spirituality? I mean, then we would be endlessly hungry and unhappy, or we will have to wait till everybody is satisfied or everybody is spiritual. It's almost like saying that if somebody is craving, is in the worldly you know, frame of mind, then will you also have to feel the same craving? Because hunger is not just physical hunger for food. So it is a very cryptic statement that Swami is making here, and that's why Hislop goes on to ask. He says, when does one really experience that he is the same as another? Because now one feels for another through compassion. But compassion is not direct experience. When someone hit a dog, it is said that Shirdi Baba had bruises. That is the actual experience of unity. I think that is the question that Hislop is asking. As I was saying, when you say that you should feel the other's pain, it is not something which is a direct experience. Of course, empathy is something that you always feel, and I think that's a sign of goodness that Swami has also spoken about. But do you really physically feel the pain of another person? Physically experience the same craving and hunger that when you see a person who is hungry?
When you see this question, you just admire the kind of clarity and the detailed manner in which Hislop is approaching this whole thing. It's so wonderful because as I read through, I get those doubts, and then I read the next question of Hislop and I feel, oh my God, I couldn't have asked this in a better manner. It really shows the yearning that Hislop has and the clarity that he is trying to get from this entire conversation. Definitely, without doubt, it's not prashna but pariprashna. One can be sure of it. So, when he asks this, when someone hit a dog, Shirdi Baba had bruises, see, that is the kind of actual experience of unity. Otherwise, it's only sympathy and empathy. Swami says, all is divine. When you're firmly established in the fact of your divinity, then you will directly know that others are divine. Compassion for others is felt as long as you consider yourself as a separate entity. Swami also is just amplifying that and saying, yes, as long as you consider yourself as separate, you have compassion, empathy and sympathy. Otherwise, when you're firmly established in the fact of divinity, then you just know others are divine, and then, in fact, you know, there is no actual sympathy and empathy. That's why, you know, I think when we say Karuna Sagara, oh compassionate one, why are you not responding? In that sense, it is meaningless, because Swami knows everything. There's nothing for him to feel compassion as such. And then Swami also says that the story about Shirdi Sai as related in books is not fully correct. The facts are that a lady made a plate of sweets for Shirdi Baba and a dog ate them. The lady drove the dog away with blows. She then carried another platter of sweets to Shirdi Baba, who refused them, saying that he had eaten the sweets she previously offered and his hunger was satisfied. The lady objected and said this was the first time that sweets had been offered, so how could Baba say to the contrary? Baba said no, that she had offered them before and she had also beaten him. In this way he gave a lesson that he was omnipresent and that there was only one life. So Swami is saying that your version of the story where she beat the dog and Shirdi Baba had bruises, that is not true. It's not that way that it happened, and Swami gives the correct version. But Swami says that that is how it is, that omni presence and omniscience comes because of Shirdi Baba or Swami. Every point in time they know, they recognize their own divinity and therefore they are able to recognize the divinity in others. But till that happens, Swami says that you have only compassion. In fact, I am reminded of a very similar and very interesting experience narrated by one of my mother's friends, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She's, her birth name is Sudha, but after marriage her name got changed and she resides in Goa. And she's been coming to Swami from the late 1960s. So she says that when she had come late 1960s or early 1970s, they were allotted a room where the current South Prashanti is, South Prashanti 1, you know, right behind the mandir. There were a few rooms there and one of the rooms had been allotted to her. And her mother had made sweets to be offered to Swami, because every time she comes to Parthi, she would get something her mother would make and send, tell, offer it to Swami. So there was a box full of sweets. So they landed in Prashantilyam, they went to their room, they were just settling in when they heard some kind of a commotion. They got to know that Swami had come out for darshan on the sands there. So they just rushed. She had come with her brother. Her brother rushed for darshan. And because she's a lady, she took a little more time to get ready. But she quickly got ready, locked the room. Locked means just latched it from outside. There was no lock as such. Latched it from outside and she also ran for darshan. And after darshan, when they came back, she saw that her brother was in a very agitated frame of mind and he was actually chasing a dog. Chasing it and trying to hit it with a stick and then throw a stone at it, and the dog was running away. She came and she said, "What happened?" He said, you are the careless one. Because of you, all this has happened." She said, "No, what happened? Why are you chasing that dog?" She said, "See what the dog has done." And she sees inside that box of sweets which her mother had made for Swami, that had been pulled out and it had been opened and all the sweets were out and some had been eaten by this dog. Then she said, "No, but I latched the door." He says, "No, it is evident that you have not latched the door, otherwise how would the dog have got in then?" He says, "Now it's over, the sweets, how can you offer it to Swami? The dog has all, you know, spoiled it." So she felt bad, but she was really wondering how on earth did the dog get in, because she clearly remembered that she had latched the door. Then she says the next day when she went for darshan, Swami came straight to her and made her get up and says, and tells her that, "You passed the examination in such flying colors and you didn't bring sweets for Swami." Then she realized, this auntie realized that she had actually written her examinations, but she had no idea of the results. And here Swami was telling her that you have passed the examination in flying colors, but you are not getting sweets for Swami. So her mother had sent sweets, but those were not the sweets for the examination passing. So she just said, "Haan, oh Swami, par kutte ne mithai khaya." I mean, she was trying to tell that the dog ate the sweets. And Swami looked at her and said, "Janta hoon, mithai khaya, pitai bhi khaya." You know, Swami said her that, told her that, "Yeah, I had the sweets, but I also got beatings." Smiled and walked away enigmatically. And, you know, for her, she came from a family that was staunch devotees of Shirdi Baba. And she was devoted to Swami when she, you know, she had accepted Swami as her God at this point in time. But for her, it was a happy connection. Because, you know, her grandmother had actually had Shirdi Baba's darshan. That's another beautiful story in itself. And she, therefore, was a devotee of Shirdi Baba. And she said that this incident of a dog eating away sweets and Swami coming and telling, "Mitai khaya, lekin pitai khaya," it exactly matches with what Swami is also narrating here. She said it matched so much with Shirdi Baba's life, and this was a very memorable experience. I just remembered that when Swami narrated this incident of a dog eating away sweets meant for Shirdi Baba.
Right, and you know, going back to what Swami is saying here about you should feel the other's pain, if you really read that paragraph, it looks like it's disjointed, you know, because one point Swami is talking about dharma, Swami is talking about thought, word and deed, and Swami is talking about doing your actions rightly, and then the next statement is Swami is asking, "Do you feel hunger if another person is hungry?" It seems a bit disconnected, but very interestingly, even as I am going through the Bhagavad Gita for the program in the evening, there is actually a shloka where Krishna speaks about a karma yogi, and he says, "One who does karma yoga, who is purified in the mind like that, he will have self-control, and the third point it says is he will see himself in every other being.
Right? Mm.
It's almost like the three points which one which you know take you one after the other. So when you do karma yoga, if you have done it properly, you will start feeling yourself in everybody else, or you will feel that the self in you is the same as the self in everyone else.
Wow.
So though it appears like it's a statement which has suddenly come out of the blue, Swami is not making anything random here. And the thing is, no, it's not only about feeling the other person's pain. That seems like one, a thing which, as Hislop was saying here, something which comes out of compassion or empathy. But the other thing which Swami would say, especially for us students, is, are you able to feel the other person's joy? When something nice happens to another person, are you also feeling the equal amount of joy?
Mm.
Now, that is something that Swami would encourage us. When you're talking to one of the old students, you know, he was saying this, that I think in a discourse or in an interview, Swami had said this. Are you feeling the happiness of the person? You know, when I am blessing another devotee or another student, are you feeling the happiness? I think he had read it somewhere in some discourse. Swami had said it many years ago. And Swami said, then you are able to feel me within you, or something like that. So this boy had read this and it had, you know, stuck in his mind. So this is what Swami wants us to do. And one day he was sitting in the third block, you know, right in front of the bhajan hall. And Swami came and Swami called one of the students and Swami was talking to him. And I think Swami materialized the ring and gave it to him. So this boy was sitting actually a couple of places away. And his face lit up with so much joy that, you know, it kind of caught Swami's attention. Swami looked at him and Swami said, Nuvendukara anavutunnavu inta. Swami said, you know, why are you laughing? Why are you smiling so much?
Mm.
You know? He said, Swami, you blessed my brother. I am feeling so happy.
Mm.
Right? He said, one of us, you blessed him and I am so happy for that. And Swami was so happy with that response. Swami patted him and Swami said, very good, very good. You should be like that. So when Swami says, are you feeling the other person's pain? I think it's not only about that kind of compassion, but as Swami would say, Swami would refer to that as, you know, mudita. Are you able to feel happiness even though the gain is not for you personally? You're able to feed off another person's joy. Swami is saying that also is a equally important quality.
Actually, when Swami is speaking, the answer is not yet complete. I just got carried away with the resemblance, similarity in the experience and shared it. Swami continues to say, during the lifetime of Shirdi Baba, not much attention was paid to him. Recognition of him as an avatar and interest in his life developed only after his death. Thus, various incidents are recalled from memory now by devotees and written down in books. The same lack of recognition of divinity is illustrated in the lives of Rama and Krishna. Krishna was considered as just a cowherd boy and then just as a charioteer. Even the life of Shirdi Baba prior to age 18 is known only to Baba, and the divinity was known only to a very few genuine devotees. Hislop says, it seems strange that only a few people recognize the avatar. Swami says, no, not strange. How would you know the avatar? Hislop says, by faith. And Swami responds, faith is one thing, knowing is another. Your wife may have faith in you, but she does not also know you. The avatar may be known at one time, but doubt arises and recognition wavers. An example is Vishwamitra, the great sage, who asked for the company of the young lads Rama and Lakshmana to help him overcome the demons who were disrupting his performance of Vedic ceremonies. He said to the king that he did not want the king's powerful armies and that the two boys, who were divine incarnations, were sufficient. Yet, upon reaching their destination, he called Rama in order to instruct him in mantras that would help overcome the demons. Waves of Maya make recognition of the avatar almost impossible. So Swami is saying that it's not that the avatar is not known. A lot of people will know the avatar, but they will not have faith. And without having faith, you get deluded by Maya and your knowledge, you start questioning that very knowledge itself, you know. You start doubting whether Swami is God or not, you know. I feel that every time when I worry or feel sad and think, Swami, what is this that is happening? Why is this happening? If at all I feel that something that is happening is not, when I say wrong, I'm not meaning in terms of moral wrong, but it is not something that should happen. It's not in the best of my interest that it happens like this. Unconsciously, I'm actually questioning Swami. I am showing that I don't have faith in a supreme knowledge, in a supreme wisdom, in a supreme love. Because this is what we discuss even under surrender, right? When Swami says surrender, it means every moment in our lives we are supposed to be convinced that whatever is happening is the best for me. But if I lose that conviction, I lose the faith. That's why Swami is saying that don't need to get surprised that people don't recognize the avatar, because they may know, a lot of people know the avatar, but faith is not an easy thing, and that is the reason why a lot of people don't, in quotes, recognize the avatar, because they don't have the faith.
Right. And the way Swami is using the words, of course, I think he's used it interchangeably elsewhere too. Swami is talking about faith and knowing. Almost like knowing is a higher thing than having faith. That's how it feels.
In one sentence.
Faith is one thing, but knowing is another. You know, you may have faith in your wife, but you don't know her completely. If you really look at it, faith is... It's something that you're believing in the unknown. You know, if you really look at faith, that's what it is. But once you have that faith, knowing is a completely different thing. It's like every act will be dictated by that knowledge.
Hmm.
Swami would say that is what is knowing. And really, if you look at it, I think not to judge anybody else. If you really look at yourself, if you were to believe completely that Swami is divine, we will do 99% of the things that we're doing right now completely differently. And that is a fact, right? Having faith is a different thing. You know, as you were saying, at the end of the day, when you have a problem, to think that Swami knows and Swami will take care, that's a different thing. But to act every moment in that realization is a completely different thing. Right? We will not run after anything else. If we really believe that Swami is God, I sometimes feel that, where is the question of any other achievement in life? Yeah. Anything else you achieve is going to be lesser than the fact that you've known Swami, you've seen Swami, you've interacted with Swami. Right? Which means there will be no craving for anything else in life.
Which is not the case.
Which is not the case. That itself means that we have the faith, but that has not become part of our understanding. Swami would often give the example, and I think we've quoted it many times. It is like knowing that fire burns. Knowing that fire burns is part of your thinking mechanism itself. If there is a burning fire next to you, the way you'll behave will be completely different, because the fact that fire can harm me is always there in your consciousness. So Swami would say, when you know that Swami is God, if that is there in your consciousness always, the way you'll act will be completely different. It is not, and I think that is one of the examples that Swami gives here. Right? Should we go into that part of the answer? Or
maybe just two more lines or few sentences just to complete this line of conversation, because Hislop says, but Swami, that is still very strange. Recognition of the avatar was so difficult in those ancient, simpler days. Yet in this corrupt and complicated society, recognition of the avatar is almost worldwide. Swami says, is it? Is it widespread? There are stories and articles about Swami, but how many persons are sure that he is the avatar? And how many of those who are sure are free of doubt? So Swami is saying that there may be articles, yes, Radio Sai may be publishing and there may be videos. I would like to, rephrase this in another way. Yes, there are thousands of darshan videos, but none of them have got 100,000 views. There are other songs and rap and pop which have got millions of views. Why is it? I mean, so Swami is saying that. And in fact, Swami says another example. You know Swami as the avatar? Hislop says, yes. No doubts? Hislop says, no doubts whatsoever. Your own experience is that Swami is omnipresent? Hislop says, yes, that is my direct experience. Then Swami says, yet, when you leave Swami at Vrindavan and arrive at your hotel, you think of Swami as being at Vrindavan. You see, it is not so easy to know the omnipresent avatar. I think we'll stop at this point, and because Swami makes it so beautifully clear that even though we have faith, we are sincere devotees to the best of our abilities, we still don't know the omnipresent Lord, because I still feel I miss Swami. All said and done, yes, I feel I miss Swami. I sometimes even now verbally and vocally and loudly ask Swami in the altar, Swami, why did you leave and go? Why couldn't you stay? going by Swami's definition, that very statement itself shows that I do not have conviction in the omnipresent Swami. And Swami says, when you say you have faith in God, when you say you know God, it's not about a form or a name. It's about the omnipresent, the cosmic form of the Lord that we are speaking about.
Absolutely. I think that itself is a contemplation and or mananam which is worthwhile doing. That if we really believe that Swami is God, as we in our own minds claim, then in what way should our life be different? In what way we will act differently? In what way will we aspire differently? In what way we will plan our life differently? I think that's something that each one of us can ask and contemplate on. The conversation is not complete here because Swami is driving a very important point, but we are running out of time. So dear listeners, do join us again next week. We'll continue this conversation, and what Swami is saying here is very important. It is timeless. The conversation happened maybe 50 years ago, but it is as relevant today as it was then. So till we meet you all next week, we'll leave you with a song. On the other side of it, of course, there'll be the program Love to Love, but we'll join you again next week at 12:30 for the continuation of this conversations with our beloved Bhagwan.
मेरे हृदय की धड़कन में बज रही साई नाम की धुन, बज रही साई नाम की धुन। मेरे हृदय की धड़कन में बज रही साई नाम की धुन, बज रही साई नाम की धुन। साई नाम गाते गाते नाचे मन चुन चुन, साई नाम गाते गाते नाचे मन चुन चुन। साई नाम की धुन बज रही साई नाम की धुन, मेरे हृदय की धड़कन में बज रही साई नाम की धुन, बज रही साई नाम की धुन। साई राम 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 साई राम। गगन है साई, पवन है साई, साई नाथ अगन। गगन है साई, पवन है साई, साई नाथ अगन। आदि अंत नहीं साई को नहीं जन्म न मरण, आदि अंत नहीं साई को नहीं जन्म न मरण। निराकार है निर्गुण साई, साई नाथ सगुण। निराकार है निर्गुण साई, साई नाथ सगुण। साई नाम की धुन बज रही साई नाम की धुन, मेरे हृदय की धड़कन में बज रही साई नाम की धुन, बज रही साई नाम की धुन। साई राम 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 साई राम। सूरज चांद सितारा साई, बिजली का चमकारा साई। सूरज चांद सितारा साई, बिजली का चमकारा साई। जल थल गिरिवर नदिया सागर विश्व चराचर साई, जल थल गिरिवर नदिया सागर विश्व चराचर साई। प्रणव नाद गुण गान साई का रे मनवा तू सुन, प्रणव नाद गुण गान साई का रे मनवा तू सुन। साई नाम की धुन बज रही साई नाम की धुन, मेरे हृदय के धड़कन में बज रही साई नाम की धुन, बज रही साई नाम की धुन। साई राम 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 साई राम। प्रशांति वासा परती साई मेरे साई सुन, प्रशांति वासा परती साए मेरे साए सुन हे परमेश्वर परती पुरेश्वर प्रेम स्वरूप भगवन हे परमेश्वर परती पुरेश्वर प्रेम स्वरूप भगवन जग उद्धारण कार्य में अपने तो मुझको भेज चुन जग उद्धारण कार्य में अपने तो मुझको भेज चुन साई नाम की धुन बज रही साई नाम की धुन मेरे हृदय की धड़कन में बज रही साई नाम की धुन बज रही साई नाम की धुन साई नाम गाते गाते नाचे मन बज रही साई नाम की धुन मेरे हृदय की धड़कन में बज रही साई नाम की धुन बज रही साई नाम की धुन साई